welcome back to another episode of Over the Glass. I am your host, Ness. I'm going to go by Ness today.
Oh.
Am I am a J?
You're AJ? VJ.
AJ.
I am a... Yes.
And I am a Drew.
All right, that was an interesting way to start. So, playoffs have started. First day was yesterday. We were like two games. Not surprised by the outcome, really, but how are we feeling?
Leafs be leafing.
not be leafing, but they be leafing.
they
doing will
leaf
be
stuff.
A leafing. If they don't figure it out. I didn't watch the game. I just was like, people were texting me. I was trying to study, because as you guys know, I'm trying to go for a certification that I've been exhaustingly studying for since November. So I was trying my best to ignore text messages from people being like, Bruins this, Leafs this, and I'm like, la 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 la. I'm not gonna watch the game. Not gonna respond to you. Not out of my mind right now. No hockey. But when I did take a break, I saw that the final score was like 5-1 or something. But prior to that, it looked like they were going to get a shutout. And the one Leafs goal was like Reeves and other people. It wasn't like their top two lines. It wasn't, you know, anybody that you would recognize as like, those are the guys that they pay money to win these games. And
well, sounds about right.
Where were they? Yeah.
I didn't pay attention to hockey at all yesterday. Yeah. But I checked the score. I think I checked the Bruins Leafs score because was it you and Elena in the Discord that was like that they were getting demolished or something. So I was curious to see. I thought it was going to be a bigger blowout, but it was only 4-0 at the time. Yeah. Whatever. I don't have a horse in the race, as they say.
My horse hasn't started racing yet, so I was...
Are they today?
Yeah, we play...
His horse is in the pen, getting ready. Yeah.
My horse is just starting to come out of the stable, you know. He's starting to trot out to the track. But tonight at 10 my time, 7... you know, normal time in Vancouver. Play the Preds.
How are you feeling?
I'm just happy to be here.
Yeah.
We're on the other side of the fence, just looking in.
Looks fun over there.
What you guys doing?
You know who else is happy to be here? Mark Stone. I don't have any more words to say about this team. They frustrate me.
With the Mark Stone thing, this is the third time this has happened. And I get there's a ton of this, like, they don't just, like, you don't just rupture your spleen to go on long-term injured reserve. I get it. But, like, you fool me once, shame on me. You fool me twice,
no, it's
shame on you. Well, whatever.
There's a lot of shame here.
There is so much shame. And this is the third time
it's
happened. The point
is, now. There is shame.
So much shame.
There should be.
This is the third time. This is the third time that this has happened with Mark Stone. He conveniently, something happens, and then he can't play. But then all of a sudden, like hockey Jesus, Easter Jesus, he comes out of the thing and is like, I'm here for the playoffs. And I don't listen.
He has risen.
He has risen again.
You know, maybe next time Jesus should take some advice from the groundhog dude and don't come out. Just don't come out.
Mark Stone is the reason for the season. Just it's so convenient, right, that all of a sudden Mark Stone comes back. We all knew. As soon as that, I think, LTIR thing went out, we were all like, again? Like, this party trick has gotten old now. And I don't know. I'm how frustrating. I hope Vegas loses. That's all.
I'm trying to see it from a reasonable, logical side, where, yes, players get injured. Yes, they usually give them a timeline. I've heard that Vegas has been really good about players who are injured and not rushing them to come back sooner than they're ready. I just think it's always so super convenient that they're ready just as playoffs are starting.
Just, oh, yeah, no, he felt really bad on Thursday, but he can go today.
But this, like, I saw this tweet that you reposted, which is why I was asking you your handle because I forgot it. Someone named Wyatt Arndt, handle the stanchion, tweeted, "There are times when I get depressed. I struggle to find a reason to get out of bed in the morning. Everything feels overwhelming." I'm like, oh yeah, that's so relatable. And then he goes, "But then I remember that if Mark Stone can make a miraculous recovery for game one of the playoffs, anything is possible. We are truly blessed." I was like, that's not where I thought this was going. It was like, okay.
I love Wyatt. That is, I seen that and was like, whenever I posted it, I was just dying laughing. I was like, if Mark Stone can do it, so can anybody, man. Like, if you're having a tough moment in life.
It's not just Mark Stone, though, right? Didn't they put out a tweet earlier in the week that they had, like, three other players coming out off of IR in time for playoffs?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't follow them, so, and my life is much happier.
No, it was media guys. So I don't follow them either.
I have anything Vegas muted on my Twitter.
Oh,
so.
No wonder you're so calm.
Self-respect.
Self-care here.
It's funny. What's so funny is, like, when Thatcher went out and the Canucks at the beginning of April put him on, like, LTIR retroactively so we could free up cap space to bring in some younger guys because of the other injuries we were having, there were Knights fans, there were Golden Knights fans out there. They were like, so do we get to say that Vancouver's cheating? Vancouver's cheating because they moved Demko back. Okay, he played the last two games of the regular season. We didn't put him in the stable and then we're like, all right, time for this horse to race today. All of a sudden, out of nowhere. Like, so I just.
You didn't have somebody jump Demko and then, like, you know, gag him and put him in the closet somewhere. And it's like, right? We need you to be injured right now.
Sit there. Stay.
Listen, if Mark Stone is so fragile that he breaks every season, I'm not sure that he should continue this career.
That's what I was about to say. Like, you're in a bad business, my man.
Like, you're doing long-term damage to yourself, my guy. Take care of yourself.
You should explore other forms of employment.
So when everybody was like, you know, Twitter was blowing up when Stone came back to practice, there was this person that tweeted out, they actually cover the Canucks, but they were talking about, their tweet was, reminder that the cap friendly seven of the Western Conference's eight playoff teams are on LTI and are above the $81.5 million upper limit in projected cap hit for this season. So congratulations to the Predators fans, the only people that get to complain about Mark Stone's return. And I replied to that being like, yeah, that's not at all the point. That's not, people are not complaining about LTIR. They're complaining about Mark Stone in relation to LTIR. So you can use it. It's just, like what we've already been talking about. Like, come on now. Like, they're clearly using it in a way where they can then bring in someone like a Noah Hanifin and the other people. Because I was looking at their cap and I was thinking it'd be like the funniest thing ever at the time when they were fighting for a wild card position. It'd be like the funniest thing ever if they missed the playoffs. And then it's like, have fun trying to figure out who to offload your $9 million over the cap.
Straight up, like when they put like Stone back on LTIR and then you started seeing other like players get moved at the end of the season and there was a chance for Vegas to be knocked out of contention, I was like, please. Please. Because now you're doing the thing where you're trying to stack your team for the playoffs again. Like, okay, you know, caps doesn't count, so we're going to put all these guys on on LTIR so that we can field the best team in the playoffs. Like, it would have, I think I would have been more excited about that happening to the Knights than maybe the Canucks going to the playoffs, just as like a sweet hockey god karma sort of thing, you know?
Like that year that the Sharks helped knock the like Vegas out of contention. Good times, good times.
I just, you know, how many times can they keep doing it before the people that are like, no, this is totally normal, are like, okay. Do we get to that point next season?
Yeah, they're currently just shy of $9 million over the cap hit with Stone still on IR. And then, well, I mean, Leonard's probably not, like, we haven't heard about anything related to him, but I'd imagine he's kind of like out the door. And yeah. So, but I mean, Mark Stone alone has a $9.5 million hit.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about that, like, you think about, like, the terms of, like, players that just signed contracts recently, like Elias Pettersson, who has a $8 or $9 million deal. Like, I know it's Mark Stone, but, like, you've LTIR, like, freed up in cap a Pettersson-caliber player, essentially, in contract value. You know, so, like, even if Stone doesn't come back, but you suddenly have a almost $10 million forward that's somewhere in the Knight system, or if they make some big type of deadline trade and pull this like LTIR stuff, then you've freed up a pretty, I mean, as far as like paychecks and caliber like spots go, like a playoff paycheck, you know what I mean, or like a top tier paycheck. That's pretty, I don't know. It's frustrating because it's hard for me to not be like, okay, well, that's not cheating to some degree. Like, it might not necessarily be cheating because it's just a loophole you're exploiting, but it's still plaintive at this point. Now that you've done it three times, especially like what's happening here with Mark Stone, I don't know. I got
just one unlucky guy.
Gosh,
darn! I'm injured again.
Sad. Vegas grinds my gears, man.
You're not even a Sharks fan, my guy.
Oh, I know.
Anyways, have you guys done your playoff brackets by chance? Because I haven't. Have you?
I have.
Have you? Who do you have going all the way? Your Rangers?
Your so realistically, I have two. Realistically
and DeLulu.
And how I want it to happen.
I like doing both.
Let's see. Realistically, I have the Canes winning.
Okay.
Mm. I had the Canes winning last year too, I think. I just think to me, they're kind of like Vegas in a way where I'm just like, how do you have space? How are you in the conversation for these people? Like during like the trade, I might be getting this twisted, but they were in some conversation with like, I think like a goalie or like a, maybe even, whoever they got from the Pens. It might have even been that trade where I'm just like, how are you fitting this person? How are you in all these conversations? And I kept looking at their roster and just being like, man, like they're pulling some magic. And like when they did get Gensel at the trade deadline and how that like first line just like, God, they were just like killing it both like on 5-on-5 and power play. So I have the Rangers beating the Capitals, but then they would, if the Canes were to advance, that one was like kind of where my toss up was for like my realistic and then my hopeful one, where I'm like, it could honestly go either way in my opinion, because the Carolina's got a really lethal power play when they want to. The Rangers got a really lethal power play when they want to. But then unfortunately, Zibanejad's been struggling on 5-on-5, and they really need him to come out in a big way in the playoffs. And so that's really going to kind of like come down to it for me. And then just really like the battle of the goalies, because Frederik Andersen came back and he was annoying to play against in fantasy playoffs. Cause I'm just like, why do I have to play against all these teams that have him? But I just think, like, they've got a lot of assets on that team that if they're all on the same page, they could be really difficult to go against.
I did the same thing. I have my you know, the realistic one, and then I have my, at this point, pure fever dream, right? Because, like, the fact that we're even in round one has still got me just like... So if the Canucks can make it through the West, I would like to see them win the cup, wouldn't we all? You know, and when I say would we all, I mean, wouldn't I? But in the East, so I will say this realistically, not saying this because I have a bias. Realistically, the Canucks performed very good against teams from the East Coast this season. So if we went to the final, I do like our chances. But the East has got some heavyweights, and I right now in both of my brackets, I have the Rangers to make it to the final. Like, I do see New York beating Washington and Carolina beating the Isles. I think that Rangers Kane series, though, like UJ, I think that's like one of the biggest potential, like, round two toss ups. That is going to be good hockey if that's what we get to see in round two. Because the Canes do, they have some, they've put together a really solid squad. And the Canes always come up to compete in the playoffs. Like, if they could find a way to just, I think, make it into the later rounds, I think the Canes would be a formidable opponent in those Eastern Conference Finals, the Stanley Cup Finals. But, I mean, like, I didn't watch any of the games yesterday. I was at the bookstore. But I'm excited to watch that, the New York, Washington, and the Carolina. I would love to see New York, Carolina round two. As a Canucks fan, what I'm most terrified of is we get through Nashville and then we have to meet LA in round two.
If we can, LA is not advancing.
No, I Edmonton's got the system to figure LA out, and so, like, best case scenario is, like, Edmonton picks off LA for us, and then we take care of Edmonton in round two, because the Canucks, whether the Oilers fans out there like it or not, we did not lose against Edmonton this season. So we've got Edmonton pretty well figured out.
That doesn't matter in the playoffs.
Listen, I'm telling you, we have had Edmonton's number. We haven't, when it comes to LA, it's like, those games have been the most boring Canucks games I've watched all season. And I'm like, they're not going to, they play trap hockey. And it's, you're just sitting there watching the Canucks, like, try to figure it out until the last, like, 3 minutes of the game. And then they score against the Kings, and they're like, we got through the trap. And it's like, too late. Too late. You should have been doing that for the last 57 minutes of action.
Yeah, I just feel like if the Kings somehow pull ahead of the Oilers, that will be a surprise to me, because all season they have been struggling with their goaltending. It has been, they've been back and forth trying to find, like, they brought in Talbot expecting him to be the first, to be their starter, and it hasn't really gone that way. So, but I mean, he's been kind of towards the latter half of the season, he'd been starting to, you know, solidify his game in the crease. But the Oilers, just like, Skinner's been phenomenal for them. But I'm actually kind of wondering, because they played him so much. And, you know, the Oilers, they're more about their, like, offensive from, like, my perspective. They're really big on that end of the spectrum. And I feel like the Kings are kind of, I don't know, they've got their firepower. But I just think it's going to come down to goaltending, who's gonna help out their team more. With the Oilers, I had been so frustrated during the fantasy season, because they kept switching out players to play with Draisaitl, and it's like, it's hot or cold. And then, of course, you can almost always rely on getting points from him when he's on the power play, because he's with McDavid. But when he's not on a line with players, like when they have, like, their after the trade deadline, they started trying to put, like, Henrique with him, parry with him, and I get so frustrated when it's like it just zeros across the board for Dreisaitl on the second line. So I mean, they've got their first line with like McDavid, and then their back end has been really like producing for them, like Bouchard and I can't remember the other guy off the top of my head. So they've got like their defense coming in to help them out. So, but I still think that like the Oilers are going to have the edge there. I just like the Kings have done well in their like rebuild where they kept like Dustin Brown and like Anze Kopitar and Drew Doughty. And then they like surrounded them with the up and comings and things like that. So they didn't really have to go through much of like a horrible beginnings of their rebuild. Like, you know, us here in San Jose are kind of seeing. From my perspective, I just felt like the Kings were never like that bad. Like, yeah, they may not have been sniffing at the playoffs, but like they were still watchable if you wanted to watch them.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Yeah.
Because LA hasn't, like you said, guys like Kopitar and Doughty are, I think, getting into the latter half of their careers, but they're still good. Like, they're still producing consistently. The lines that they're on are still performing pretty well. They still fit into the scheme and the identity of Kings hockey. So it's been, as far as like them rebuilding or going through like that transformative process, the Kings have done pretty good to be able to bring in prospects at the right times, or like call ups and recalls from who is there. The AHL is the Ontario Reign, right? So like they have like, you know, pretty good like pipeline of moving people up and letting guys plug and play and fill in the gaps and see how it all evolves and works out. That's why and in some weird way it's so interesting that like, you know, like us, like I don't want the Canucks to get to round two, because it is, the Kings have always been a formidable opponent, and that they've always been really consistent about their identity and the way that they play the game. It's like their whole strategy seemingly hasn't evolved too much over the years. They've just like fine-tuned it for their opponent and for the moment. I am curious though. I mean, I have a running joke between me and my friends that Dallas isn't a real hockey team. It's just something we joke about. I haven't seen a lot of the Stars play. How do you guys feel about the Dallas-Vegas matchup?
Goaltending is going to be a big factor there as well. But not the tipping point for them, but I just feel like the Vegas is going to have to find a solution for Jake Oettinger. Like, he has been hot all season. Like, I saw a clip the other day, I think it was during the regular season, where he was off on the left side of the crease, like some play was happening there, and then quickly the puck went off to the other side. There was like a big wide open, like empty net, and just like the luck behind Oettinger to just turn around and casually like lift his stick up and like hit it out of the air are just like,
dude. That was
human. Angels are watching Jake Oettinger right
for
now.
For real, though. Because, like, I watched that replay so many times, because it was like, there was no panic. He was just like, he just like threw the arm up and was like,
got this.
Like, paddle save right on a wide open net. I was like, wow. How
just
casual,
everyday,
like a clutch
everyday
save.
Everyday Tuesday things or something.
Yeah. I train this in practice every day, actually. Just, that was such a smooth. That's such a smooth space. I don't watch a lot of like Stars hockey, so I was curious to get you guys' take. I think like perfect world scenario is they pick off Vegas in round one, just because that would be karma for the Knights. But
I mean, in my realistic bracket, I have the Stars going all the way, but then losing to the Canes. And I honestly don't really know, mostly because I also don't really follow the Stars that closely. I know that, like, just from following it from a fantasy perspective, like, Robertson kind of seems like he's had an off season. That top line of Hintz, Robertson, and Pavelski, like, I benefited from them just clicking at all cylinders like last season, and I didn't really see the same thing. And then also with their power play, like I don't recall who's on their back end for power play one, but that guy was injured like halfway through the season, and they were like bringing up some other guys, and like Sagan was injured for a little bit. He would play on the second line, and like when he was in the lineup, what's his name? What the hell's his name? Duchesne. I was going to say Duclair, and I'm like, he's not on the star. Duchesne would be hot when he's with Sagan, but then when Sagan got injured, he was like a ghost out there. And so it, I think it's honestly like, I mean, even with Vegas, like they haven't been as good this season, you know, and they were at risk of not even making the playoffs. I mean, I can't really say much more than that because I don't follow them, but like even like with their goaltending, like Hill has been like down several times during the season. And like Thompson's been okay, but like they're not as superhuman as they were last season.
Question.
For sure.
Who ended up winning President Trophy this year?
The Rangers.
Oh.
Curse.
They're not gonna win then.
You shut your mouth.
This is like, I have not. Usually I'm very whatchamacallit. Like I pay decent amount of attention to hockey, but this season I've just had too much going on and I have barely been able to keep up, so I don't know which teams are good and who's not. So this bracket I'm gonna do is gonna be interesting. Both are probably gonna be pretty chaotic.
Not to spend too much more time on the Rangers, but their second line has been carrying them through some games.
Is that the Panarin?
Panarin has been like off the hook.
Yeah, he has just been
having an amazing season. The type of season you'd want to see Mika have, but it's okay. Brad could take the spotlight, but you know, you need more than just like the one line, and like the Rangers power play is decent, but over the years they've started to neutralize Zibanejad, like at the back door, the one-timer shot. So now they've had to get more creative, which they have, which like Trocheck and like Panarin have been able to like produce, and Kreider out in front of the net. But like, I just think going back to what we were talking about, that the reason why if Rangers advance and the Canes advance, I think it's going to be a really good series because they're kind of similar in the sense where if the cylinders are all chugging away in the right direction, you've got a really competitive series. Or if it comes down to like the hot line of the top line for the Canes, and then if they produce on the power play, it's similar to the Rangers, like, and their goaltending is pretty decent. And like from last season, they made an upgrade and they brought in Jonathan Quick, which I feel like has been really good for them. Because they were relying so much on Shesterkin to play a million games, and then when he needed a break, like on a back to back, then they brought in, I can't remember who they had last season, but it just wasn't good enough. Like, you need somebody, as much as I hate to give praises to Jonathan Quick, like he is a pretty good goalie, and you need somebody who's like maybe not like 1A, 1B, but someone who is reliable, you know, like how the Wild did with like Marc-Andre Fleury. You kind of just, you know, the guy's gonna play a couple more games, but you can't just like kind of how I feel with like what they did with the Oilers. Like, they're definitely relying on Skinner right now. I mean, obviously they brought in what's his bucket last season and that didn't work out. So it's not like ideal that they put, that they're in the situation, but that's why I'm a little concerned that, like, did you play him so much and now are you gonna like ride him into the ground if the Kings come out in a big way in this series?
I forgot Quick was in New York, but I am happy that the Rangers took the President's Trophy, because I hands down believe that that thing is cursed. And towards the end of the season, like when the Canucks started losing a few games, I was like, maybe this is a good thing. Like maybe we don't need that President's Trophy. Like, remember what happened in 2011? We don't need that again.
But what if it would have been the only thing you win this year?
I'm fine. It's fine. It's fine. It's all right.
Would you rather lose a cup with a trophy or without, you know?
I would rather us lose the cup and the President's Trophy and just have Quinn Hughes take the Norris than for us to even come like 100 yards within the President's Trophy again.
Let's chat about your Canucks, though. How do you feel about this series? Realistically.
Realistically,
blue shaded glasses off.
I mean, okay, so realistically, like we've always done really when it comes to the playoffs, we've always had Nashville's number. I don't like the false sense of security knowing that gives me though. And I feel like there is this optimistic sort of caution, I feel like, in the Canucks fan base where some people are taking it to a different level of extreme where they're like, the Preds don't stand a chance. And it's like, but listen, they had one of the hottest teams at the end of the season. The Canucks were kind of stumbling and bumbling along there. Like we had just started having like some of the old habits and patterns and stuff start coming back that we had to course correct really quick, and there's still the potential that they haunt us into the playoffs, into the postseason. So I'm optimistically cautious. I know that we fared well against Nashville this season. They were a tough opponent, but the games were good. Games were gritty, lots of big hits. There's always some sort of bad blood between Nashville and Vancouver.
You say that about every team, though. Like, everyone's out to get
spread love, not hate.
Everyone's out to get the Canucks.
That's true, though. That's not wrong. It's not a conspiracy. No. No, I mean, like,
that's why everybody likes the Sharks, because we're just so fun and happy. That's why we own the sea. all you all is just like kicking each other's ass in the sea, and we're like, we'll be over here.
We'll be bumbling along over here.
It's because we're like we're the one Canadian team in the ocean. They're like, you don't even go here.
Canada's really close to you in proximity, though, so.
Yeah, but they're not Canada, Nessa. Okay, we don't just
you're
turn
not
over.
Canadian. You're furthest from Vancouver as possible in the in the freaking continent here. Well, North America.
I could be Canadian.
No.
It's what's in your heart that counts.
No.
That's what I've been told my whole life. No.
Not about citizenship.
True. Yeah, with all of that being said, listen, whatever happens, happens. And you at least get four chances, right? You at least get four chances. Round one, you could go 0-3, but you at least get the fourth chance. So whatever happens in the first four games, or fifth game, sixth game, seventh game, however many it goes, just happy to be here. I didn't think we would be. And
we'll check back when they're close to being eliminated.
Oh. I see.
Still happy then, Drew?
No, I just refuse to say one way or the other. That's one of my superstitions, is I refuse to say, like, yeah, this team is going to go all the way, we're going to do it. Because just as soon as you start barking a big game, and I've seen it across so many sports, just like my favorite one was like Jalen Ramsey of the Jacksonville Jaguars a few years ago, when everybody was like, they're going to win the Super Bowl, the Jags are good. And Ramsey was like, that's right, we're going all the way. We could pretty much just give us the Super Bowl now. And we went. It was like one of the most disastrous seasons of Jaguars history. I won't do it. I will not sign a check that my ass can't cash. That's for damn sure. Nor will I jinx any potential happy news for my team. So you know what? If we win, I'll be a happy, emotional wreck. I'm going to have hot boy summer if we win the cup. and if we lose in round one, well, you know what? Like, I got further than I expected, and we didn't go too far enough for me to get attached to any real outcome. So
I kind of hope the Canucks at least make it to the second round, just for the fans. Because it's y'all don't get to experience this very often.
No. I mean, the last time we went to the playoffs, it was the bubble. And that was, again, you know, it's like, yeah, it was the playoffs. So we made it to the second round. We lost the game 7 in Vegas, or to Vegas, but it wasn't the same. They didn't grind out 82 games. You know what I'm saying? There wasn't a full season length worth of battle. I think the Canucks got in that time during the play-in tournament from, like, points percentage. So this is the first, like, real taste we've had of a full 82-game gamut with us actually doing something top of the standings and actually getting somewhere. So, yeah, like you said, you know, like I said, we if we lose in round one, we at least got to the postseason. If we lose in, like, the Western Conference final, I'll be immensely devastated. It won't be hot boy summer. It'll be sad boy until October season. So I can purge it from my memory.
Sad boy summer.
Sad boy summer for sure.
Okay. I want to switch the conversation here now and quickly talk about our faves, because we always have to fit in the Sharks, because this is, we're miserable over here. We want everyone to join us in our misery. Yesterday, the Sharks did their locker room clean out while y'all are getting hyped up and excited about playoffs. We're over here packing up our shit, getting ready for the summer.
We're excited for the draft. Yeah. That is our Stanley Cup this season.
It's true. I think we're all really excited and we're very hopeful, including Mike Greer. The media peoples spent a whole, like, 40 minutes talking to this guy, asking him a bunch of questions about where he thinks the team is at, what he's excited for in the future, talking about Will Smith and all these other stuff. And I was able to catch maybe half of it before I fell asleep. I just have to say, like, I am really, I don't think I've caught too many of his pressers. Comfort, appreciation for how honest he is about the way he talks to the media, because they asked him some some pretty blunt questions. One of them was like, is this rock bottom? Like, how are you feeling about it, blah blah. And he kind of had to laugh that off and was like, I hope this is rock bottom, because I don't know how it could get any worse. But from there, he was like, yeah, you know, we're going to try to look at some pieces we can add here to kind of improve this. But then he was giving a lot of credit to the players for, you know, the chemistry they were able to keep in the locker room, and explain, like, there are some teams that go through this who, like, the locker room is completely, you know, it's not, oh my God, what are words? Everyone's fighting and bickering, and it's just not great, right? It's just toxic in there. And he said that a lot of, like, the guys came in there and worked and lifted each other up and kept each other in good spirits and everything. And he gave them praise for that. And yeah, I don't know. Jay, you said you also watched a bit of it. Do you have any thoughts?
I'm trying to find the quote, and I think it was kind of like what you were alluding to. I think that they were asking him about maybe, like, moves he was going to make and things like that. And he kind of, you know, something that you had mentioned last episode, where he's kind of looking at it as, like, the making moves to sustain the positive culture aspect. And, like, obviously wins and losses are important, but that is also key in a rebuild, keeping, you know, the morale high as much as you can when you've gone through a really devastating season. And I feel like that needs to have a bit more credit given. And because, you know, at the end, statistically, like, yeah, this team sucks. But there's more to, like, I was thinking the other day, and I was trying to find the tweet that I had seen it from before we came on today, because it was an interesting perspective of, like, how critical people are in terms of how the Sharks are building upon for the future versus a team like the Oilers that are, you know, their objective is they must win at any cost. And there was something relating to talking about Kane and how, like, you know, we're familiar kind of with how that all sort of went down from him being his contract terminated with the Sharks. And we don't really know too much further than that, other than the Oilers, not surprisingly, deciding to pick him up. And it's like, yeah, he is a productive player, but at a cost. Like, he could potentially cause ripples in your locker room that can disrupt all of these building aspects that you need to achieve your goals, whether that's a rebuild, whether that's going to the cup. And I swear, I wish I had found, I could recall where I saw it, but it seems like, well, right now I think he's injured, but like I saw some talk about like how other veterans have had to kind of like keep him focused in the direction of winning for this team and being a team player and things like that. Because like we've seen when he was with the Sharks that when he's on his game, he is a very vital asset to your team. But at a certain point, certain things within his personal life or just with him as a player, it could start going south and he can become very disruptive as somebody in your locker room and out on the ice. And I feel like on top of the things that we already talked about with the Kings and the Oilers series, like that's probably going to be a big factor moving forward for them. Like they obviously brought him in because they need him to like do what he was doing, why he was of interest despite all this other stuff that was his baggage that he was carrying around. At the end of the day, it's like, yeah, these organizations, they their focus is winning. And if there's a player that can help you win, you put on the shades and you forget all this other stuff. It's like, our locker room will be different, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't have evidence to say that that he isn't infecting, that he isn't affecting the locker room. But that is going to be something that if your team starts, like you're talking about, like if a team is just bickering in the locker room, maybe some guys are slacking and they don't give a shit and whatever. And then they like bring down the team. And then you've got someone like a McDavid or Draisaitl that's like, they're the leaders, but they also need the support of all the other players that are supposed to help them, you know, advance. Like, it's interesting to see the way that folks are going back to the Sharks, like how critical they are of the Sharks, and like a little strange that they're like, like what we talked about last episode where they're like, oh, they need more guys like this. It's like, but are you not seeing that we have guys like this? Because it's not like a Crosby. It's not like a McDavid. Like, you know, the 10 people that you like to talk about, you know, throughout the season. Like, there's guys that we have. It's just the guys that you don't give airtime to. But then a team that's going in the opposite direction in the cup, it's like, their players almost have to like babysit other players to make sure that they are doing their homework. And otherwise you may not have brought those guys in into a rebuild team, but you will risk it for a team that's attempting to win at all costs. And we know how desperate the Oilers are currently to get a cup.
Yeah. To your point, Greer did give shout outs specifically to players on the Sharks who have played a big role as being veterans to help the younger guys. You know, that whole topic of the Sharks don't have any veterans on their team, blah, blah, blah. And Greer's over here like, well, he gave credit to Vlasic to help helping the younger defensemen. He said that Couture has been very involved, even though he's not, you know, in the locker room and on the ice with the guys. You know, the few games that he played, he was able to show a lot of the young guys how to work on the penalty kill and like more defensive games and all that. And he said that there was improvement in those aspects of their game after he left the lineup again. And then, you know, giving credit to Granlund, Sturm, Kunin even, which is like, I don't know if the media people asked that question specifically because of what was going on outside of of Sharks Media, but I thought it was nice that he actually named a lot of players and was like, yeah, these guys played a vital role in these parts of developing these young guys. As well as, you know, the excitement over the new guys. Everyone wants to know whether Will Smith is going to come in to play on the Sharks next year. Greer says that he thinks he's ready for the NHL, but it's the kid's decision, right? It's his life. It's a big step to take and life-changing and whatever. And then he also named a few of the free agents that he hopes we can keep. He named the few that he said that he's going to let walk, and then named the few that he wants to keep. But again, they're free agents. It's going to be their decision. A couple of those guys I think he mentioned was Justin Bailey and Ryan Carpenter, because he said that they worked really hard. Bailey specifically, he praised, was like, he had an opportunity, he ran with it and this and that. And I was like, you could see it, but I don't know if I see him staying.
Bailey?
For reasons. but
Justin, yeah. Justin Bailey, right?
Yeah.
I'm sad that we didn't keep him when we had him, when we let Bailey walk. He's got some grit. He's quick and he can get to the dirty areas fast. I don't know how he's been for the Sharks, but I always appreciated what he brought, just the tenacity he brought to the Canucks lineup when he was dressing for us.
Yeah, I mean, you could see it. I do feel
like
he's
gonna give Bailey a contract. He's been someone that like has been grinding out there, has created opportunities, and we need somebody who's going to be like that, like on a third line as like maybe like that's his primary spot, but the ability, like when they were moving around and juggling around the lines, like he's been able to kind of be a factor like anywhere he is. And the fact that we're getting rid of LeBanc,
for sure,
Hoffman, and Barbara is leaving, like Barbana. LeBanc and Hoffman alone, that's already like over $9 million off of our cap. And you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see like where Couture is at come training camp, but even then I think because we're gonna probably have some other dudes be moved, like there's gonna be space for him.
Yeah. Another thing he mentioned was that he hasn't closed the door on the possibility of making changes to the coaching staff, which obviously he can't commit one way or another. He hasn't even done the exit interviews. I just think that that was interesting to throw in there because, yes, the Sharks had a really bad season, but also, was it really the coach's fault?
I'm curious to see what's going to happen with the Barracuda. Because I kind of feel like, because they haven't had, like, they didn't have,
yeah,
I want to imagine not as bad as a season than us, but I think they maybe play less games, so maybe, like, the record doesn't look so bad to me, but it just seems like they've been kind of, and I know they, like, our prospect pool has been a rather shallow, but they have had, like, veteran guys, like, in that lineup, so I just kind of wonder, like, is it time to at least shake it up there? But in terms of like the Sharks, like it just really, I don't want to have these guys have to learn a whole new system again, especially with how much the roster is probably going to be shook up this season. Yeah, it's just not a good time to do that.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, pretty interesting discussion. If you guys haven't watched it, they put up the presser up on YouTube. It is 40 minutes, so. We also interviewed a bunch of the players, which I actually haven't had a chance to watch yet. But, you know, quotes are coming in and out
when
of there. So.
I saw Luke Cunnan talk about, like, how he would be open to a multi-year deal. I kind of went, I was just like,
2 years, that's it.
I was just slowly internally screaming. It's like, that's cool or something, but.
That reminds me. That reminds me, someone asked Greer how he's going to approach bringing in other players in the offseason. And he said, like, yeah, we'll see what we can do to bring in, you know, a bigger name for, you know, to, you know, the whole thing where if you bring a bigger name, it brings fans to the stadium, whatever, to the arena, puts butts in the seats. But he was also very upfront about how we don't want to just go about looking at it that way. You know, we don't want to spend all this money on a big name or, you know, sign players we currently have, veterans, to multi-year deals. And then later down the line, when we have to sign younger players, it's going to bite us in the butt. And then not like we're going to have to make these big decisions or we won't be able to sign the younger guys. So we want to be really smart about how we handle that. And I was like, yes, thank you.
He had mentioned that he's not interested in really signing players to super long contracts right now. And like he also made that additional comment about like, you know, we don't want like the contract to be ending when they're like 38, 39. I was like,
bless it.
He had mentioned that like Matt Benning, like that was like the longest contract he was willing to sign, 4 years. And I actually like, I mean, Benning got injured and hadn't been here all season. But I do like Benning, and I hope that he will be healthy and can stay healthy next season. It's like all these guys that you don't realize that were like injured like all season and just like, oh, wow, look how terrible this team is. They've got a bunch of kids running around. It's like, yeah, because the guys that we brought in to actually like help them out are hobbling around. Like a Couture and like Benning, and there, you know, some other guys along the way that were getting injured. And then like when Blackwood got injured, oh my God, that last game of the season, it's like he's dead. Stop. He is like freaking, was that? No, I think this was the third to last game when Cooley was just like laying on the ice, and I'm like, baby, no, precious baby, it's not you. And he's just like, you could just feel it. He's just like had zero help and was just, yeah, he was just over it. And then he got pulled again, not because of him, just it's like a mercy pull, and they brought in Romanoff. I'm like, this team. And that was against the Oilers, wasn't it? That last game. Who was it against?
No. That was second to last game.
Yeah, the Oilers like literally slaughtered us for like two periods. And then, I forgot who was the last. It was like so bad that, yeah, I can't even recall it anymore. It was, the Flames, where we gave someone else their first NHL goal.
Again, yeah. At least Zetterlund, I watched a bit of that one. Zetterlund spoiled their shutout with like 14 seconds left. But
the game against the Oilers, like they legit were just like, you could tell no one was talking to each other. Like even Brett Hedekin on the broadcast was like, these guys are not talking to each other. Like freaking Cooley passes it in a direction because the defense is not talking to him, gave it away, and just they were all just out there like playing a solo game, just attempting to touch the puck and get it out, touch the puck and get it out. And just like no no one attempting to make a play. They're just like deer in headlights, just running around like crazy and kind of embarrassing. But all that to say,
it's over now.
Like we had the like, who was gonna predict that Couture was gonna get this weird ass like pelvic injury that he like he's been trying all season to like figure out? Like, who could have predicted that? It's like, yeah, I might not like that we've got Couture into like his latter years of his like hockey career, but he's still a veteran presence that can help, like we were talking about earlier with the Kings, like how Drew Doughty decided he was gonna stay and help the rebuild. Like Drew Doughty's like Brett Burns age, you know, like he could have gone off to some other team to like, he's like, no, I rather stay and help throughout this rebuild. And you know, and that's kind of like where Couture is at, where he wants to go down with this ship. And you know, yeah. So, like a true but captain. It's like you needed him out there, even though he's kind of not really where he used to be anymore. But it's still important. Just like a Matt Benning, you may not think he's the greatest defenseman in the world, but that's not really why we brought him in. But he does have that veteran presence, and he's not out on the ice. So, yeah. So, we do have a lot of kids out there. But what else are you going to do?
Yeah. Also, to your point about the Couture thing, like, all this season, we never had all of our centers playing, like, ever in one game. Because Couture was injured for most of the season. And then I think Granlund started off the season injured. And then Hurdle went out. And then he was traded. So it was never like a complete full, like down the middle, all of the guys that were brought in ever played. And so I think that really affected how the season played out as well. But hopefully it's to our favor. We'll know in June. July, whenever the draft
Everyone
is.
Everyone who's saying we need to fire Mike Greer, it's like, okay, Mike Greer did not mess up Couture's pelvic bone.
Take this hole.
Right.
I saw someone, what an image. Like, I just quickly looked through, like, comments on, it must have been on Shang's tweet, and like, okay, first of all, why are there Vegas guys, like, commenting on, like, on our tweets? Like who's living rent-free in whose mind? And then there's also this other person who, God, what did they say? I can't remember anymore. I have to look back. But anyways.
Okay, I'm sorry. That was just an interesting
or people
image.
Or people are just like, oh, Mike Greer's doing a terrible job. And I'm just like, yes, because I'm sure you would do so much better. And then I looked on their profile, and they've got it showing that they play fantasy hockey. I'm like, of course you do. just like how I think.
So do I. Now.
I could manage this team.
Right, exactly. Expert.
Fantasy hockey is so fun, but it's so, like, fantasy sports are so bad in that they have everybody who has access to, like, basic stats and a bracket. They're like, I could run a team. Yeah. I'm the next greatest GM.
I mean,
alive.
I manage a fantasy fantasy league, so that means I can totally take Bettman's job. Totally.
Okay, I have an actual question. Does the GM have to be really good at math to do all these contract talks, or do they have like an accountant or someone
they've
to do it for
them?
They've got
a whole army behind them.
Like, you don't have to be good at math to become a GM. Because I could totally do it.
Same. That's why everybody else thinks they could too. They're like, no, he has an assistant for those. He's an assistant with a calculator. I wouldn't have to do that.
Oh boy. Shall we talk about
down
the queers?
For Commissioner Jay, though.
Oh, Commissioner Jay?
Commissioner Jay of the queers.
This one over the glasses. Our fantasy hockey league.
Jay just sits there so humbly, like, yes, this is true.
I don't know where we're going with this.
I don't know either. Drew's just having a ball over there.
Listen, it all just happened at once, and then that's how that happened. So that's
Jay's
title.
Things happened, and it happened, and so we're happening. You know what else happened?
Other things.
This Taiwanese-American drag queen, Nymphia Wind, performed as a giant boba drink at the winning season 16 of RuPaul's Drag Race. Fabulous. I don't watch RuPaul. Jay, this is your category
so
here.
So, I just need to give a shout out to Nymphia Wind because, like, I, from the start of the season, when she walked out, obviously I was excited for her because representation matters, but every freaking runway design, look, everything, like, she's just been killing it. She has been amazing. They're, you know, for like the structure of Drag Race, they also bring in a lot of their personal stories in there along the way, and those are always really, like, touching to me, especially when Drag Race expanded to the Philippines, and it was like I was crying every episode because it's like, not only are they queer, not only are they Filipino, not only are their designs inspired by their culture, it was like overload for me. It was also a moment where I could share this avenue of queer culture with my mom, where we would otherwise maybe not, like, intersect there. But I felt like she would find it interesting because of the cultural aspects of it. And then I also took it as an opportunity to a lot. Some of the cultural things kind of like went over my head because like I didn't grow up with those. With those stories, or like I don't have reference to the historical significance of things, so I was able to ask my mom a lot about that stuff. And then when they brought in guests, they were also like they pulled from celebrity guests in the Philippines, and that was also really great because my mom would recognize them and she'd get into it and she'd tell me stuff about it. So it was a great like bonding experience. So I feel like that's kind of why I'm drawn to Drag Race, because I want to see and hear these stories. And Nymphia in particular, I was always rooting for her throughout the entire season just because she was so creative in all her designs. Like, I encourage people to go out on her Instagram, we'll look at her design. They are just gorgeous. She puts a lot of heart and just thought and just her inspiration. She makes majority of her outfits, which you don't need to, but the fact that she does just makes her even more amazing to me. And then in the finale, and this is at the point where if you haven't watched it yet and you don't want spoilers, you might as well skip to the end here somewhere. But leading into that finale, I kind of felt like one of the other finalists, Safira Cristal, like she had been killing it all season. She was also really amazing, and I kind of felt like she was probably gonna have the edge because just performance wise she has been amazing. But when it came down to Nymphia and Safira, freaking Nymphia comes out with this outfit. Like, if you go and watch the finale video, it's before she opens up the coat. When it's around her, it's fucking Bulba. And like when she came out, you know, it was a very tiny image of her. And then when she came up closer to the stage, I was like, she is not fucking Bulba. She's fucking Bulba. I was just like, I was living for it because I'm like, yes. And then I saw people like commenting about like how they didn't. I watched one of the like commentary videos that follows the finale hosted by Trixie Mattel. She brings on another drag queen like every week to watch through it and comment and give their critiques and stuff. And Trixie had mentioned that she actually didn't realize that it was Bulba. It's like it took her a while to realize that. And just for me to be able to relate and to see that in that moment just kind of like is one of the many, many reasons why I love the cultural and the personal aspects of that Drag Race brings. And then secondarily, I like the designs because like I have a history of like designing like outfits and things like that. So like the creative aspect of it is also really interesting to me. But prior to her going into this final lip sync, she came out and did like her number, and then they talked about her, had a brief interview with her saying, you know, how you feel being in the finals. And then also the finalists get to invite people in their lives to come live, not live, to come in person to watch. And she brought her best friend and her mom from Taiwan. And from the moment when they showed this baby picture of her to asking her relatives in attendance how they feel about, you know, Nymphia and her success, I just had an emotional just experience. I don't even know how to describe it. I just started crying when her mom was talking about how proud she is of Nymphia and all this stuff. And I was just like sitting there being like, why the fuck are you crying? I hated and I love the moment, but I was just like, I just couldn't contain myself. And like, I know at the end of the day, it's because she's Taiwanese. I'm not Taiwanese, but I am Asian. And so that connection's there. The connection of like how Asian families, kids, folks that have an immigrant background. We have this history in our upbringing, in our culture, where we seek validation and we seek connection in how different we are from our parents all throughout our childhood. And the fact that this mother, and one of the things is always like having your parents say how proud they are. Because I know when I was growing up, my parents would show how proud they are by just like me not getting in trouble or something. It's because like, oh, you did a good job. Well, you know, that is to be expected. And it's like, and then I would see,
yeah,
you know, my peers who weren't Asian or don't have this disconnect with their immigrant parents, they would get like, good job, honey. Well, and nowadays it's almost like a weird reflex to me. And I know you guys have seen it where someone will praise me and I feel really uncomfortable. It's because I don't know how to respond to it, because I have not. I don't have a history of that happening. It's not normal to me. And it's like, it's like, I'm unsure how to respond to it. But that's kind of how, like, I felt throughout my childhood. So going back to this, when Nymphia is getting all of this, like, praise that's spoken, verbal, and like real from her mom, it's like, I can relate to that so much, because that's like what you've just been like striving for. You just want them to verbally say how proud they are, but the way that they're proud of you is just culturally different. Like, of course they're proud of you, but there's a history of it just not being like verbally acknowledged or shown in ways that, as someone who grew up in the US, how they do it here. Like, they're very verbal about it. They're very, you know, and then also the additional layer of the fact that she's queer, and that's something that like is another hurdle. And the fact that her mom is just like, I love my child. And like, this also resonated with other stories from the finalists. Especially there was one of the finalists, her drag queen name is Plain Jane. And in the beginning of the season, I did not like her. I felt like she was narcissistic. She just was like rude. She was just like really blunt. And sometimes it had no place. It's almost like, read the room, girl. Like, no one needs you to be berating somebody when they're already down, type of thing. And it's like, it seems like, I don't know if this is something that she's doing as like a performance for the camera, or this is how she actually is. And then throughout the season, you start learning about, she's got like deeply rooted, like internalized homophobia, because she has Russian immigrant parents. And she grew up with the culture of like her parents were super successful. They spent a lot of time around other Russian immigrant families. And, you know, so they're also trying to like not only have a spot here in the U.S., they're away from their country, but then also they've been taught at their age that this is wrong. We know that Russia is like super anti-queer. And it's like, so not only is she having to chip away at those like coping mechanisms of trying to be super perfect and being offended when other people aren't doing their best, it all comes from just a place of like, you know, that's kind of what she was influenced to do. And the fact that even her mom was there and saying how proud she was of her, I'm like, oh my God, so many things to be so like so overwhelmed with emotion about. But the difference is in that situation that I didn't start bawling when like Plain Jane's like mom was like praising her or whatever. But just something came over me when like Nymphia's mom started doing it. I'm just like, oh, representation matters, man. It's so beautiful. Yes, your child's amazing.
Queer joy. Love to see it. I kind of want, it kind of brings up this topic also of, you know, not a lot of queer folks do get to experience their parents being proud of them for something that's queer related. And so, like, I can understand why that was really emotional for you.
Yeah, it's funny because I don't have the experience of being pushed away by my parents, but those stories always hit hard as well, because there was a time where there was a fear, because there have been friends in my life who have left me, and you don't want to have to feel that way again. And so, yeah, I just feel like shows like Drag Race, like, I would just always encourage folks to kind of like give it a little bit of your time, because even if you're not that interested in seeing men, you know, dress up and portray and a fantasy of being a woman and like the whole creative fashion aspect of it, like I said, the reason why I got so into it is because of the representation and the stories that you can relate to. Because for a long, long time, I actually was not interested in Drag Race, because like I can appreciate drag, but I just wasn't really that interested in watching a show about it. Until, and then also there was a brief point in time when RuPaul would not allow like trans folks to be participants in the show, and you know, so Ru had and this is probably because she's an older person and maybe rooted in like, you know, old ways of thinking about drag culture, even though there have been plenty of trans folks who have paved the way for drag history. That was another reason why I didn't really want to get into Drag Race, because I was like, well, if it doesn't support drag trans people to be in drag, like, it just seems very gatekeepy, and I don't want to give any of that support. But then the first season that I actually did watch to its entirety and was of interest to me was the first time that a trans man was participated in that season. So yeah.
Yeah. So did you guys, I mean, I think that we're up to an hour now. I don't know if you guys wanna have this other conversation, or I could talk to you offline about it. How are you feeling?
I'm here for a good time, not a long time. Okay. Or I guess, well, you know, whatever. However, that was meant to be supportive, and then I thought about it, and I was like, maybe that wasn't the line to use in this moment.
I just had questions about, I guess, gender expression. I'm not super knowledgeable in a bunch of all this stuff. I'm still learning. I haven't been super exposed to a lot of queer culture, and like, I want to be, and that's what I'm trying to do here, right? I've also realized that I haven't had a lot of opportunities in my life to experiment with certain things, and I now have some space to do it. And I'm curious, because I don't know. Okay, I don't like labels for myself. I don't, like, I had a friend come up to me and ask me if I identify as mask or butch, and I was like, neither. I don't like those terms.
Okay, first of all,
it just doesn't sit well.
I also don't like labels, but, and no offense to your friend who asked that, but if we are going in, if we are humoring labels, I don't see what the difference is between mask and butch. Is that not the same thing?
I don't know. I tried looking it up, and it's very, like, the lines are very blurred to me.
Yeah, yeah. Those like, micro labels that pop up within the community that are, they're all just so, like you said, the lines are blurred. There's so much weird overlap, and it's, like, they all the definitions vary by like the smallest marginal things. And there, it's just, it's such a nuance to, like, the micro labels inside the community are so nuanced. And even as somebody that's still, I like to say, in the process of still figuring myself out in different ways, I come across these things and I'm like, what the hell are you saying? Like, is that not the same thing as, like, those three categories over there? So,
right. If you want a label for yourself, that's great. But I have a problem with labels when other people start, and I've had this experience where people are like, well, Jay, you can't do that. You're butch. And I'm like, first of all, I never said I was butch. Second of all, what are you talking about? I can't date another person who feels comfortable in their own skin looking masculine because I am awesome at, like, who made that rule? And yeah.
So, okay, I guess my question to you guys is how, I don't know if you're fully there yet or what, but how did you guys come to terms with your gender expression, not identity?
I've always known, and I know that's a weird way to like sort of phrase that, but like I come from a very perilous sort of childhood, but I never really like threw a tantrum or made a display about not getting my way until I was forced to conform to societal gender roles by my family. And that would always happen on like the day when I was in preschool. I still remember this to a T. There's a day in preschool where my dad was insistent. It was picture day. He was insistent that I wear a dress. My dad was also big on me not cutting my hair, which was a huge identity crisis ever since I was younger. And my dad was adamant that my mom put me in a dress to send me to picture day. And at 3-4 years old, the only thing I could think of is, why am I being made to do this? No other boy is wearing a dress to picture day. What the hell? Boys don't wear dresses, right? Because like when you're that young and that, you know, new, fresh in the world, your idea of gender is really just based on the societal norms that we've developed around them, right? Like I loved Hot Wheels and race cars. That was boy things. I love sports. That was boy things. Like complete. It was just always just innate to me. Thankfully, and this is one of the reasons why I love and appreciate my mom so much, is that where my dad had a very conservative and traditional outlook on how he thought I was supposed to present myself to the world, my mom was a huge tomboy. She still is a huge tomboy. Like she's very athletic. She does, you know, she loves sports and very similar interests to me. And my mom, when I was in like first grade, I went like school shopping with her for school clothes, and my mom immediately kind of just let me take the lead, and I went immediately to the boys section and started picking out boys clothes and everything. And my gender expression was never hindered by my mom. My mom always went to sometimes insane lengths, if you know the kind of stuff that I grew up in, to protect that autonomy of myself. So it was never like my gender expression was never really hindered. And my mom seen it from a young age, like how much comfortable I was to even just be given the option to present with how I wanted to present myself. So it always just made like, it's weird to sort of say it, and I don't really know if it helps Nessa, but it's like I've always known just like that innate sense of where I would be the most comfortable. As I got older and like, you know, like the biological puberty started happening to other trans people out there, yikes, right? Like it sucks, and it's like normally where the doom and gloom starts really settling in. I went through like a year of like, I'll call it forced conformity, where, you know, I was 15, I was entering my sophomore year of high school, and there was a lot of external pressure and a lot of people talking behind my back of like, well, Drew's a lesbian, Drew's gonna be a homo, you know? And it's like, well, first of all, lesbian always felt foreign to me anyway, because I didn't, even at a young age, I didn't know what being a transgender person meant or consisted of. that always felt like to me like something I should have called out of like work sick for. Like, I'm got a case of the lesbian today. Like, it just never, it felt like a very foreign term, like, to me, and it just never, you know, like, registered. It was weird. And so I dealt with a lot of homophobia and slurs, derogatory things that were said in the shadows, but I was very well aware that they were being said because my family is as a flair for the dramatic. So they like to bring up the shadows to the light anyway on their own regards. And I sort of went through like this imposed like conformity of myself. And that was when I put that on myself to try to make everybody else happy is the first legitimate time I tried to kill myself. Is the first time I tried to actually commit suicide is when I sort of conform to what everybody else had expected of me my whole life. And then after I went through that, I had a really terrible episode of, suicidal ideations. And then 3 months later, I found out, I just came to terms. I've actually Googled the stuff I was experiencing, and then that's how I put together that I was trans. So it was like this really like kind of full circle moment, but it's always just been innate to me. Like, it's so funny because even my ex and I used to argue, and she would be like, "You're just a dude," and I was still sort of like following, like, you know, into like the weird self-imposed paradigms of like society and X, Y, and Z, why I could never transition and wouldn't be happy if I did, and like stuff like that would get said in an argument, and I'm like, yeah, you're right. Like, I don't know, like, who am I fooling anymore besides like maybe the five people that think that they have an idea of who I am. So I don't know, man. If it feels right, Nessa, if it feels true to who you are, you do it. And if it's something that you're curious about, like, truly, if it's just something that you think that would maybe bring you a little bit more comfort in your own skin, give it a go. And if you're like, no, then you're like, okay. Like, then you know that that's not it.
Yeah, so I am experimenting with it right now, right? Like, me having this short haircut now. Like, I didn't always have short hair. I chopped it all off for the first time in 2021, I think, just to try something new. It didn't super go well with the people around me. I felt like I liked it, but the people around me kind of didn't, and that didn't make me feel good. But, you know, I let it grow out again, and I was like, okay, it's fine. I don't mind having longer hair, but I do feel more feminine with it, which, again, I don't mind. I still identify as a woman, right? But there's something about having short hair that brings me a bit more confidence. And so, like, I'm leaning more towards that right now. The way I dress is usually for comfort, but it is, I've always considered, like, I've always been a tomboy as well. Like, that's how I grew up. But I don't know, like, having, like, someone had used he, him pronouns for me once, and I don't like that. It does not sit well with me. I don't like people calling me mask or butch. It does not sit well with me. I'm still a woman. I still like femininity. And, you know, on a rare occasion, I will wear a dress. It happens very, like, rarely, but it will happen. I do like wearing eyeliner sometimes, but I don't know, this is this weird thing that I've never given too much thought to, because like I said, I haven't really been a part of the queer community. I don't surround myself with queer folks in my day-to-day life, except my siblings, right? And they're just as sheltered as me, except for my older sibling, but they're all the way across the country. So it's just like an interesting time in my life that now I have a bit of freedom to do this. I don't have this, what is the word, like, this sort of, I don't have people, like, with my parents it's a little bit different because, you know, you rebel against your parents regardless because you want your own happiness, but there are other certain people in my life who just didn't make me feel good about certain things that I would try, and I don't have that in my life anymore, right? So, like, I have this sort of freedom to do things without having that nagging voice in my head, like, oh, they're not gonna like it. Right? So I don't know, I'm just curious about how y'all went about your stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like you have a pretty good idea of your, like, your gender identity, which is what you said. It was just, like, the gender expression part of it.
Yeah.
It's, it, I think too, sometimes when we come to these sorts of like inflection points within ourselves, and especially with being members of the queer community or the, you know, just society at large, I think sometimes we still get inside our own heads too much about it, where we put too much pressure on how we want to express, or maybe even subconsciously like applying a label to how we wish to express it. The best thing is, like, then I try to keep this in mind for myself, is there's 8 billion people, give or take, at any moment experiencing life on this planet at some point in the day. And those 8 billion people are going to express their gender in a unique way too, right? Like, there's going to be things that work for maybe this fraction of a million people, but this fraction of a million people is just going to feel like, it's going to be like a case of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, like too small, too big, just right, you know? So like, it's a, even for cis people, gender expression is so nuanced and complex. That's what I'm saying. Right? I mean, like, not just like in the scope of like new and in the sea of cis people, like gender expression is a wild thing, and it varies from people to people. I know some of the most macho men on the planet who take time out of their day, like every 72 hours, to make sure that they don't have the first lick of leg hair. Like for real, like it's such a nuanced and like complex. I mean, it's not really complicated as much as it's complex. And so, like, you know, if you want to experiment and you want to try things that make you feel maybe more comfortable, especially now that you said you have like that personal freedom, you don't have to worry too much about other people putting things inside your head that might influence doubt or second guessing yourself, or get, you know, just gaslighting. You don't have to worry about that gaslighting rumination that sort of happens. Like, do it. And if you try it one time, you try it for like 15 minutes and you're like, I don't like this, then you know, like, you know instantly. You don't have to, don't feel pressure to try anything twice, especially if you knew the first time that it just wasn't, something was off about it. But it's such a nuanced thing. And remember, like, whatever conclusion you come to for yourself, that's what works for you, and it might be drastically different from somebody else that also feels the same way, right? Because it's just it, on top of everything else, we're also super conditioned by our life experiences and the things that we go through and the things that, you know, the environments that we've grown up on or the environments that we are currently in. So yeah, I think you should just be patient with yourself, be curious, and have fun.
I think the conclusion that I'm coming to, possibly after that conversation I had with my friend, is that if I were to put a label on it, I think gender fluidity in like just expression wise is something I'm leaning towards, right? Because I don't really care to look one way or the other all the time. So I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, being queer.
It's a beautiful, diverse planet, and you can do... You can do whatever you want here, really, truthfully. The rest of it, I mean, most of this stuff is just made up. Some rich person in power with money came up with it. So, the nuances of the universe.
Well, all right. Thanks for indulging me. I don't know if you guys have anything else y'all want to throw in here.
Be gay, do crime.
Do crime. Alrighty, I guess it's our episode this week. Thanks for joining us.
MJ. I'm Nessa.
That's Commissioner J. I'm Drew.
Bye. See y'all next week. Bye.